We have spoken over the past few weeks on the show a lot about Paul Robeson. This morning, we talked to the author of a powerful new biography about the large and unconventional life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. The name of the book is Eslanda. It is about Eslanda Essie Cardoza Good Robeson, who lived an extraordinary life of adventure and purpose. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Barbara Ransby to the round table to tell us a little bit about that life. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of what brought you to this subject. You're a professor in the Department of African American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies and History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. What brought you to Mrs. Paul Robeson?
Well, about 10 years ago, I wrote a biography of a woman named Ella Baker, and I think I became very attracted to biography as a genre. I'm very interested in the lives of African-American women in particular. They often are kind of in the margins and the footnotes of the main narrative about American history and world history. And Eslanda was someone I was familiar with when I was an undergraduate many years ago now. I had done a paper on her life, and so I got a little taste of what that life was about, and it had always stayed with me. You know, this woman who traveled in the 1930s under really arduous conditions in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world, and who, you know, had a lot of contradictions in her life, difficulties in her life, and a lot of privilege in her life at the same time. And I just, you know, wanted to peel back some of those layers and learn a little bit more about what her life had been about.
How much or how difficult is it to separate her life and her accomplishments from that of her husband? I mean, you do write in the book of obviously there was a large shadow cast by her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I, you know, inescapably I have to talk about Paul Robeson in the context of telling her story. I mean, they had a 44-year partnership. They were very close personally, politically, but it was a difficult marriage and it was a complicated relationship. And I think one of the things that kept Eslanda Robeson going and was really important to her was her independence. So there is a narrative that is her own narrative connected to Paul Robeson, but not the same. And so, you know, I was always navigating that line between her identity as Mrs. Paul Robeson, which she valued, and I say in the book, you know, she kind of in an interesting way asserted that status as, you know, I'm Mrs. Paul Robeson, was a way to get people's attention. But once she had people's attention, often, you know, what she had to say was, you know, her own message, her own ideas, her own contribution. So it was a fine a line to negotiate, but I really did focus on what I thought were her contributions and her more independent strand of her identity in the world.
And I do want to address those contributions specifically, but just before we move on, do you feel that they fueled one another in the sense of were instrumental in fueling one another when it came to the so many and the very strong causes that they supported and talked about?
Oh, absolutely. I think they had an intellectual relationship from the very start, and not one without friction. They disagreed, they debated, they argued about ideas, about politics, about art, but they constantly came back to one another. You know, Essie was initially trained, and Essie was what she's called by mm-hmm. her friends, and after reading so many letters with that name, I sort of call her that. But she was originally trained as a scientist, so she had this very pragmatic business orientation about her, and Paul, on the other hand, even though he was trained as a lawyer initially, you know, became very much an artist and was much more relaxed and fluid and casual. So they were an interesting pair in that regard, just in terms of two very different styles. But yeah, they did fuel one another. They enabled certain things in the other person's life that I think would have been difficult, if not impossible, otherwise.
You talk about her time in that pathology lab, obviously a time when career options for both African Americans and women were tough. And give us a sense of how she came to that role and ultimately how she progressed out of it.
Well, she had been a science major at University of Illinois, and she moved to New York City and finished her undergraduate work at Columbia University's Teachers College, and then she was able to get a job at Columbia Presbyterian working in a pathology laboratory. And she had an intention of going to medical school at one point. She was fascinated by science. She was fascinated by medicine. But she abandoned that soon after she met Paul. I think initially she thought she'd go back to it. But she also, you know, had other passions and other talents. And she got really caught up in the moment of the Harlem Renaissance, when there was so much creativity being generated by African Americans who had kind of migrated to Harlem. She became Paul's manager. She became a very strong proponent of his artistic career and immersed herself in an artistic and literary community that existed in Harlem and later in London that was very important to Paul's career, but also important to her own intellectual development.
And when you talk about that intellectual development, that brought her all over the world and encounters with some amazing people.
Absolutely. And I really had to resist, being a little bit starstruck myself as I went through her papers. You know, she has a friendship with Jawaharlal Nehru, who, of course, was the first prime minister of India. She has a relationship with Jomo Kenyatta, who becomes the first president of Kenya, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. And these heads of state, these larger-than-life people. And then, of course, the literary community, Eugene O'Neill and Noel Coward and Zora Neale Hurston and Virginia Woolf. And so these were the people that animated her world. Emma Goldman, the famous feminist anarchist who herself had such a wild, colorful life, was someone who she met in London in the 1920s. She had this amazing group of people that she maintained relationships with and corresponded, supported, disagreed with, had fun with all over the world.
You write quite beautifully and quite convincingly about her energy and generosity and meeting these people and really developing quite a network around the world.
Yes, she did. She had a personal network, and it eventually evolved into a political network. I mean, I talk about her large life. It was a colorful life. It was an animated life. In some ways, it was a life of adventure also. You know, she kept journals and diaries throughout her life, and so she writes about her travels, you know, when she's on a boat going down the Congo River in 1946, when she's in a completely isolated small village in Uganda in 1936. She writes about her sort of daily experiences in those contexts, and it's quite fascinating. But the other part of the relationships and the travel, which was very purposeful, was her increasingly left-wing political views that took her to all kinds of places, including China a few months after the Mao's revolution in China, which was, you know, kind of precarious time to be there. But she was curious about social change, and she was curious about the anti-colonial movement. So she wanted to meet with people on the African continent who were trying to achieve independence. And she was very curious about socialist experiments around the world. So her politics took her to many places as well.
When you talk about her politics, at what point for you do you believe that she found her political voice as an activist?
Right. Well, I think it was a gradual process, as is always the case, I think. But the 1930s were pivotal for her. She's, of course, born in 1895, so she's already in her 30s at that point. When she travels to Africa in 1936, she's there for quite a long time. She's there for several months, or 2 months. And she travels to first South Africa, where she meets with anti-colonial activists and many of the people who later become leaders of the early African National Congress. And then she travels to Uganda and she meets with people there who are either suffering under colonialism or resisting colonialism in certain ways. Then in 1938, she and Paul make a decision to go to Spain during the Spanish Civil War to lend their support to the Republican forces, who were the anti-fascist forces that were fighting against Franco ultimately lost. Those two experiences were really pivotal. Also in the 30s, they visit the Soviet Union for the first time. And they visit the Soviet Union in 1934. It is, of course, the time of the Great Depression in the United States, and many people were suffering because of the excesses of capitalism. And so there was a sense of an appeal and an attractiveness about a system that promised an alternative. So I think all of those factors, the anti-colonial movement in Africa, which she saw firsthand, the anti-fascist movement in Europe, which she saw firsthand, and the possibilities of a new kind of socialist society, which she saw. She didn't see the whole picture when she went, but what she saw very much intrigued her and attracted her.
Individually, what do you think her legacy is?
Well, I think her legacy is one of enduring repression, which we haven't talked about, but they were victims of the McCarthy era witch hunts and, you know, lost their house, and Paul was blacklisted and couldn't work for a number of years. And so
she was incredibly outspoken.
She was very outspoken. I mean, just defiant at every turn and paid a price for it. But in addition to that repression, I think there was also resilience, because she managed to continue to expand her network, to continue to speak in her own voice, and really refused to be silent. So there was a largeness about her life that was very impressive and awe-inspiring in a way. And then there was a real determined, purposeful approach that she had to life, which I think really made an impression on me.
The name of the book is Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Wife of Mrs. Paul Robeson. It is published by Yale. Barbara Ransby, thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate it. A great pleasure.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you so much. The name of the book is Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Wife of Mrs. Paul Robeson. It's published by Yale. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.